Ivan Walter, reel two.
Sorry, continue. You were in the hold.
Yeah, all our gear and everything was down in the hold, and we were packed in like sardines. The smell of the fuel and the cooking food, which was higher up the ship than us, all seemed to congregate down low, and I, for one, was very sick. I think I ate about a half a can of tin fruit every day till I got on land again, and I swore I'd never go home if I had to go by ship. But
How long did it take?
it was about a 7 day trip, and we Aitapi, when we arrived there, was very unprotected. There was no landing facilities. The ship was anchored offshore, and Americans came out with their little landing barges, and we went down rope ladders and were taken ashore.
What was the general feeling on board ship, knowing you're about to go into a war zone?
Well, I don't think it was any different to the general feeling. You know, we just accepted that things were happening, and no one seemed very concerned about it. We just were, you know, looking forward to getting there. And
Had you been told what your job was to be once you reached New Guinea?
well, we hadn't been told specifically, but we knew that we were fighting troops and we would be going into action.
The idea was that you were working in conjunction with the Americans as a sort of mopping up crew, weren't you?
No, well, actually, we took over from the Americans. We didn't work in conjunction with them, although we did have Americans handling the landing barges. When we got to Aitapi, after setting up camp, we had to unload the ship, and we'd be taken out on these little landing barges, and the stuff to be unloaded was coming over in rope baskets, and with the swell and that, 1 minute it'd be over you and back against the ship, you know, and it only wanted one of these to go, and that would have done more damage than the Japs. But
This was ammunition and things like that, wasn't it?
oh yes, and stores, food stuff, clothing, so, you know, everything that we needed up there, and all the cook's gear and that.
Did you feel as though your role was secondary to the Americans at all?
Not at that time, because we knew we were taking over from them, and we were never in action with the Americans on landing. Our troops just took over from the Americans and they left.
What situation was the war at when you reached New
Well,
Guinea? I mean, as regard the Japanese position there.
actually, it's been said that there was no need for our war. The Japs could have been just left there till they'd run out of supplies and the actual war had finished, and then they could have been rounded up. But for some reason, I don't know what, but we were sent in to clean them up, which there was a book written about this called The Unnecessary War, and perhaps it was unnecessary.
Did you feel that at the time? Was there any inkling that that was an unnecessary action to be taking, to be sent off there?
No, I never questioned anything. I just did what I was told.
Some people believe that it was a part of Blamey's idea of sort of showing his
Yeah,
strength.
yes, this could have been right, but you know, I didn't know at that time. I just did what I was told.
So you were to be initially dropped off at Aitapi, but you
Yeah.
were to then work your way back to Wee Wak. What was the reasoning behind that?
Well, Wee Wak was a big supply base for the Japanese, and the idea was to capture Wee Wak, and that would, you know, break the Japs up and bring the end of the war much closer. But of course, it wasn't that campaign that ended the war.
So tell us a little bit about your initial impressions of New Guinea when you arrived.
Well, when we got there, we soon settled down, and the climate took a bit of getting used to. But my impression was that not very nice, because I was on a work party one day and there's about eight of us standing on the back of a truck, and next minute there was a searing pain on the back of my neck, and I turned round with my fist cocked to dob the bloke behind me for putting a cigarette on my neck, and there's no one there. A wasp or something had stung me, which made my head swell up like a balloon, and right down to my navel, my whole body swelled up. I went to the RAP and the doctor didn't know what to do, so he put me on no duties for a week. And after about a week, the swelling had gone down somewhat, but never knew what bit me, and I got no real treatment for it except a couple of Aspros.
The weather was another thing you could
bet on rain every day about 4 o'clock for sure, and it didn't just rain like it does here, it just came down in bucketfuls.
How did that make life in the camp more difficult?
Oh, well, actually the camps up there were never too comfortable, because some places you'd have mud and slush and continual rain, and moving up the coast, all we had was two-man shelters, and you just made the most of it. It was just like a small tarpaulin, enough to cover two blokes lying on the ground, although we did have... I was just trying to think of a term, like a Hessian bed that you could put two poles through and just keep up off the ground if you had time to do it. But otherwise you just laid on your ground sheet and on the ground. But there was no more tents until we got back to Wee-Wak and the war finished. But
was there this sort of continual... nothing quite dry feeling?
Yes, all the time. And things rotted fairly quickly in those conditions. And going up the coast, another thing that struck me at first was the smell of dead Japs. You know, you mightn't see them, but you could smell them where they'd been killed and left. And it was a shocking smell, sickening, terrible smell.
Also, I mean, the smells associated with rotting vegetation in the jungle would have been not so pleasant.
No, I remember when we first landed and had been where the Japs and the Yanks had been in action, where there was quite a few boots and different things lying around with the bones of the foot still in them, and we're having a good look at these, and our regimental sergeant major came along and he said, don't worry about that, throw them away. He said, you'll see a lot more than that before you're finished.
How did that sort of general feeling then sort of prevail on the morale of the troops? You know, the smell of the jungle, the smell of dead Japanese. And
Well, it was something that we had to accept, and I think most of us just thought it was part of the game and accepted it. But no, I can't hear anyone remember anyone being too upset about it. It was one of those things you had to accept, and you did, because you were a soldier.
I understand that Adachi had his headquarters in Wee-Wak. Is this the reason you were going down there from...
I think that was the main reason. That, as I say, Wee-Wak was a big base, and the Japs were in strength in that area, and they had pretty good food supply there with native gardens, and so the idea was to clean them up down the coast. And
well, this is the other thing, that people say they were withering on the vine.
Yeah.
In some respects, that was actually quite not anywhere near the truth.
What, the Japs?
The Japanese weren't actually withering.
Look,
the vine. They were doing quite well.
Oh, they were. There's no doubt about it. The Japs were... You must give him credit for, you know, how they would fight the war out. They weren't quitters by any means, and they did a lot of damage. Yeah.
Why was there this difference? You know, why were they such staunch fighters, as it were?
Well, might be. I can't explain that, but it just seemed to be inbred into them that they you fought to the last, and they that's why they didn't like the idea of taking too many prisoners, because they thought it was dishonourable. They'd rather die fighting than give themselves up. Mm. Very few Japs were taken prisoners, although a few did were captured, but not too many.
Was there a fear amongst you and your friends and mates of the Japanese soldier being this very sort of fierce warrior?
Oh, no, not. We knew that if he attacked, we had to stand up to it and do our best, which we did. But there was no fear, but we were very careful, because you, in that area, you didn't know where he was. He was all around you, maybe. Back in the Iderby days, they reckon that the picture show, the Yanks had a open air picture show set up, and the Japs used to come in and sit and watch that with the boys.
Did you ever have experience of luxuries like a picture show in the jungle at all?
Not after we left Iderby. Oh. No.
Tell us about the trip down to Wee Wak. What did that entail?
Well, it was a lot of foot slogging and a lot of heavy carrying, because at different stages we'd be carrying mortar equipment as well as our own. That meant you might be lucky enough to get the base plate, which was terribly heavy, and at times you'd be carting gear for the signallers, and that could be a battery equivalent to a car battery, which was very awkward to carry. And we very seldom had the luxury of just carrying our own gear. You had to carry additional
stuff. What did your own gear entail?
Well, you'd have your pack and your pouches and plenty of ammunition, your rifle, if you was a rifleman, or a Bren gunner, he'd have his Bren gun, and plenty of ammunition, grenades around your belt, and which was really enough in those conditions, because you could, in some areas, you'd be taking a step and sliding back two-thirds of the way and dragging yourself up, and it wasn't easy. But
how long did the journey take?
Well, we landed in Iderpe in February the 15th, I think, and well, the war didn't finish till August the 15th, and we hadn't got into Wee Wak by then. The 2nd 4th Battalion had been in, but we were still in the hills behind, and had gone down to Cape Wom for a break. But it took the whole of the campaign, you know, to... Wee Wak was consolidated almost at the end of the war. Mm.
So your main task on your journey down was, you were, I understand, involved in patrols of the jungle area.
Yes, a lot of the time it would be a section or a platoon patrol, and you'd have to go out, the officer would have a map reading, or the sergeant, whoever was in charge, and you had to go out and perform your duty, and perhaps you'd run into a few Japs, and there could be a casualty or two, but sometimes you wouldn't see a Jap, but and other times there might only be one shot and one of your section would be killed, and you wouldn't see who fired it.
So the tactic of surprise was something that the Japanese had down pat?
Oh, yeah, well, they were sitting pretty all the time waiting for us to come, and they didn't have to come and find us. We were looking for them, so they just sat pat and waited.
Mm. What sort of tactics, other than the ones you've mentioned, the snipers, did they use booby traps and things like that as well?
Not so much. I don't recall any Jap booby traps in that area, but at night we used to set our own booby traps. We'd have, say, an empty condensed milk tin, and we'd lash that to a tree about 18 inches from the ground, and take the pin out of a grenade and slip it into the tin and attach a very bit of fine wire across the a track or whatever, and it meant that anyone coming along at night would trip over the wire and pull the grenade out of the tin and go off. Well, I guess a few pigs were killed, but also a few Japs, and I do know of one chap that he was setting the booby traps for his platoon, number 16 platoon. I was setting them for number 18, and he stepped back over his own booby trap and killed himself. So,
so what were the worst conditions that you would have to face in, along this journey to WEWAC, do you think?
Well, the worst conditions were, I'd say, at night time. We'd dig perhaps a small flit trench for protection, and you'd bed down in that. And when you woke in the morning, it would be full of water. You'd be lying in the water, although the water would be warm, warmish, and most uncomfortable, you know, to be wet and like that all the time. But I don't know, we just seemed to accept it. I can't remember too many moaning about it, but it's just one of those things you knew you had to accept. But that would have been the worst. And you had the natural vegetation up there. You had gimpy vines, you had lantana. Now, the gimpy bushes, they had a big green leaf on. And I know of one chap in my platoon, he wiped his bottom on this gimpy leaf, not knowing that one side had all these little needles in. And he was in agony. I know he was away in hospital for about 3 or 4 days at least. But, you know, there's all types of things you have to be so careful of.
I understand that you also had to be careful of the US Army at one point.
Well, at Cape Wom, where the Americans with their lightning fighter bombers were supposed to come in and soften up WEWAC, but they got their capes mixed up, and they did over the other end where the Aussie troops were. We had slept at Cape Wom that night, and our battalion had just moved off from Cape Wom onto the beach. And the Americans came in and did Cape Wom over properly, and they blew up quite a few 25-pounder guns and killed quite a few. But not going back to Cape Wom, I can't tell you the casualties, but I do know a very good friend who was 37-year-old and had been sent back to what was called the Olds and Bowls, just doing guard duty around brigade headquarters. He was killed, and he was supposed to have been sent back to a safe area. But I know there was a couple of American barges at Cape Wom at the time, and they opened fire on these American planes, but our blokes didn't. They just wondered what the hell was going on, I think.
This is when you were nearing an action that you were supposed to take on a place called 710.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right? Could you tell us a bit about that?
Yes, well, when we left Cape Wom, we went a short distance towards WEWAC, and then we had to cut what was known as the Big Road, which led from WEWAC into the hills at right angles to the old German road, which we'd been moving on for some time. And to get to this big road, we had to go through a sack-sack swamp, which...
Could you describe a sack-sack swamp?
Yeah, it's these sago trees are so thick, it's like going through an Australian thicket. But all up to your waist would be this muddy, mucky, dirty, filthy water. And to make things worse, there was a lot of rotten stuff lying under the water, which of course you know would trip you up. But it was a shocking day. I think it would have been about the worst day we had up there. And I remember a friend of mine, our officer, who was also a very good friend, he kept slipping over, and we were one each side of him with our hands under his arm, lifting him up and helping him along. But we got through. It took nearly all day, but it was a terrible experience.
What was the average day like? I mean, when did it start and when did it end?
Well, you'd stand to about an hour before daylight, because that was the time you'd expect an attack. So everyone would be up in their foxholes, and like during the night you'd have your normal sentries out. Although in some situations you'd be 2 hours on, two off all night. If there was two in a slit trench, one would sleep for 2 hours and the other would be on guard, and this would relate to every slit trench. There'd be one on all night in that slit trench. But you'd stand to about an hour before daylight, and you'd stand to about an hour before dusk, and you'd be ready for an attack. And then all night, of course, you'd have your sentries, because the Japs knew the country well, where we didn't know it. Mm.
So you'd be expecting attacks in the early morning and just before dark.
Yes, and that doesn't... also during the day, when you were on patrol, of course, anything could happen then, but you'd be expecting that attack mainly early in the morning. That would be their prime time. Or just on dusk, disturbing. So.
What do you think was the greatest physical stress that the average serviceman experienced in New Guinea? You talk of 2 hours on, 2 hours off sleep. I mean, sleep deprivation would, I assume, be one of them.
I remember our platoon was in the forward position, and I was in a slit trench with a chap called Sandy Shearer. My cousin was in the next trench with another chap. And Sandy and I were two on, two off all night. And we had an Owen gun. And I woke Sandy and I said, "Your turn, Sandy." And I butted the gun on the parapet and it fired automatically. And so that was all right. We just did our 2 hours off, two on. Next morning, my cousin said to me, "Did you hear that Jap rifle during the night?" I said, "That wasn't a Jap rifle." I said, "I butted the Owen and it fired." He said, "Christ, we stood to all night." So these things happen. But the getting back to the Owen gun, you didn't want to knock them too hard on the butt. Or even if the safety catch was on, they'd still fire.
What about rations in the jungle? What was your daily ration?
Oh, well, it was never the same, but we'd always carry a tin of bully beef and some hard biscuits, and that would be your main ration until you set up a semi-permanent camp and you'd get a cook up and he'd make up something that was hot, you know, but you couldn't count on it.
So what was it that you missed most, do you think, when you were in the jungle?
Oh, look, I can't remember what I missed most, but I just accepted I'd eat anything at the time, and bully beef tasted pretty good to me.
Were you able to write home?
Yes, yeah, we could write home.
Did you? What did you long for most about, you know, Australia, possibly?
Well, I know the first thing we did when we got back to Cairns after the war was just go into a restaurant and have sausages and eggs.
We've been talking about you and the 710 feature.
Yeah.
You're talking about the old German road and marching through the Sacsac.
Yeah, well, after we got through the Sacsac swamp, we were on the old German road for about a day till that area was cleared. And then our job was to attack this feature known as 710. And it was a terrible job getting there, because we're in this very rough country with quite a few ridges and carrying this extra gear for mortars and signalers. I know a chap behind me was carrying one of these batteries for the SIGs. Next minute I heard it go down the slope. Whether it was an accident or whether it was on purpose, I don't know. But anyway, he'd had enough of that battery. And on May the 14th, we got to the base of 710, and that happened to be my 21st birthday, so I always remember that date. And a couple of patrols went out with native scouts, and it was decided next morning we'd attack straight up the slope to 710. Well, this attack failed, and there was a few wounded at that in that action, and we reformed again down the bottom, and our OC, Major Bailey, said, well, this afternoon we're going to do it, boys. So in the afternoon we belted up the slope again, and this is where we had the casualties. I think it was 6 killed and 22 wounded, and we eventually got a foothold on one end of the ridge known as 710. That night the Japs infiltrated a bit, and there's a bit of firing going on. Next morning we consolidated in slit trenches, and because it was quite late and getting dark when the action of the first day was completed, we started doing patrols along the ridge to get the Japs off the other end, but every attack we made was turned back. We just couldn't get through. They were dug in. They had pillboxes and plenty of machine guns. They had snipers up in the trees, and we kept getting casualties. We went round. We sent patrols round to the back of the hill and on the sides, but they were well covered. We couldn't do any good at all, and they just sat up the top and held command. But they decided after, on the 15th we did the first attack, on the 27th it was decided that they'd fire about 2,500 artillery shells, and the planes had came in and bombed. Not much from the planes, but they did come in. And what they did was they set up a few covered Bren gun positions where we were, and so that the shells wouldn't do any damage to the chaps on the Bren guns, and the rest of the company was withdrawn down the slope. We just left everything in our slit trenches and went a few hundred yards back down the slope because of this barrage that was coming through. When it was over, my platoon, number 18 platoon, led the charge, and there were so many trees down, you were jumping logs and limbs, and we eventually got up to where these pillboxes were, and we shot the Japs that were there and cleaned out the position. We'd had more casualties. There was a couple killed in that charge and a few more wounded, but we overran that position and got a bit of cleared land a bit further on where we dug in, and then they said, well, a section at a time, go back to your old positions and get your gear. So I went back to my slit trench, and I didn't have a thing left. One of our own shells had landed in that slit trench, and all I had was what I stood up in. But I went to the Q sergeant, and he gave me a toothbrush and something else to keep me going. But it was quite a memorial action, that one. It was very tough because of the snipers, and the Japs were just sitting there waiting to, you know, shoot our guys. And as I say, the patrols that tried to get my contact with them were just sent back every time. We couldn't do any good that way, so it really got down to the big bombardment to soften them up.